We wanted it to feel like a little French restaurant, neighborhood French restaurant. And we invited all of our friends. Some of them didn't get to eat that night, but...
Hey, Bomb Squad, you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, the show that's all about women and food. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, coming to you from Newsstand Studios in Rockefeller Center in the heart of New York City. Today's guests are the mother-daughter duo, Alice Waters and Fanny Singer. Alice is the force behind the legendary California restaurant Chez Panisse, which turns 50 years old this year. And she's the founder of Edible Schoolyard, the organization that advocates for free, healthy lunches for school children. It's a goal that shouldn't be so radical, but it is. Fanny is the author of Always Home, a wonderful memoir I enjoyed immensely, and she just curated an exclusive collection of limited edition prints for the home kitchen with Absolute Art. We'll be right back with both women after this word from our sponsor, X Rosé. As some of you might know, I'm a major Francophile, and in the summer, nothing feels more French to me than sitting around with friends and enjoying a glass of rosé. So I'm excited to tell you more about today's sponsor, X Rosé. That's spelled A-I-X. X is produced by the Maison Saint-X Winery, founded 140 years ago in the beautiful countryside of Provence. The X winemakers have been able to take advantage of the warm days and cool nights of Provence, along with the mineral-rich soil, the famous Mistral winds, and an elevation of 1,400 feet above sea level to produce their fragrant and well-balanced wine. X Rosé is a gorgeous pale pink color and is fruity and fresh on the nose and the palate, thanks to the Grenache, Syrah, and Sanso grapes. X is exactly the kind of rosé I love, crisp, bright, and beautifully balanced, so it goes perfectly with whatever you're eating or snacking on. Maybe some cheese and fruit, a salade nichoise, even a pizza. I know that's not French, but it's still a great combo. Look for X Rosé at your favorite wine shop. Again, that's X as in X marks the spot. Learn more at xrosé.com. Now for my chat with Alice Waters, who joins us from her home in Berkeley, California. Alice's latest book is We Are What We Eat, a slow food manifesto, and I am always thrilled to talk to this food world legend. Alice Waters, welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. This is such a thrill.
Thank you so much.
You look wonderful. It's great to see your face.
Likewise.
Even if it's over a computer, thousands of miles away. Alice, I want to go right into it. This year, which blows my mind, marks the 50th anniversary of Chez Panisse. Take us back and tell us about the opening of the restaurant.
When I think back now, I just see myself madly tacking in the rug up the stairs as people are waiting at the front door. And I, you know, it felt like a big improvisation because we didn't know what we were doing. We really didn't know how to cook for a lot of people. We wanted it to feel like a little French restaurant, neighborhood French restaurant. And we invited all of our friends. Some of them didn't get to eat that night, but...
That's so funny. What was on the menu?
We had a pâté en croûte. And we had duck roasted with an olive sauce. And we had plum tart.
That sounds so good. Is there one dish that has made frequent appearances over the five decades?
I guess I would say salad. Mesclun salad. Because that has never left. I didn't mention... But I think we had a choice of salad or cheese after the main dish. Maybe that didn't happen the first night, but that happened the first week. And it's always been there, even if it's a little pile that might be on the side of an entree dish. It is omnipresent in the restaurant, upstairs and down.
What is the Chez Panisse vinaigrette? Is there a special vinaigrette that has lasted all these years?
Great olive oil. Great olive oil. It's always the secret. Really good red wine vinegar. I always put, garlic in the base, pound it with a mortar and pestle.
I was going to say, as soon as you said garlic, I saw you with your famous mortar and pestle.
Salt in there. But that's the basis. And every year we have an olive oil tasting, blind tasting, and make a decision about the olive oils we're going to use that year. And in the last couple of years, the California olive oils have been right there with the ones we've always loved from Italy. It's hard to believe and wonderful.
That is wonderful because I know how much you love local things.
Yes.
Alice, what is the situation at Chez Panisse today? Are you open? Are you closed? Are you partially open?
We are a very small place and we can't open the restaurant until we don't have the protocols. And so we will probably not open for quite a while, maybe after the 50th birthday, around October 1st is a projection. But we have been open for food to go 5 days a week. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. On Sunday, we can take advantage of the parking lot behind the post office, and we do kind of a farmer's market. But the whole goal is to keep the main cooks employed and to be able to support all of our suppliers. And we're able to do that, and we feel like we can probably do that until Christmas.
I know your suppliers are like your family, so I know how important that is to you.
Mm-hmm. Completely dependent upon them. And I just know that there are a lot of people who come to the restaurant who want those ingredients, who depend on us to provide them.
Now, just to clarify, because Alice, we have listeners from around the world, they might be wondering, why is the restaurant still closed? They might not realize that California had much stricter regulations than other states, because a lot of states are open and operating again.
We want to be very careful. And because Chez Panisse is so small, that in order to make it work financially, we have to really have it full. And I think also that we're really uncomfortable with working in the kitchen with masks on. We're a group of collaborators who like to taste and share ideas. And it makes it very, very difficult under these circumstances. But we know we want to welcome people back. We're going to really make this work, and people can always come, buy food, and make a picnic, take it home. Getting food to go and doing all my tasting and giving feedback, and I feel connected, even though I'm quite at a distance.
Give us a little virtual taste. What is Chez Panisse to go? What are some of the wonderful things you're making?
Well, wonderful salads. I mean, we've been shaving all of the vegetables and making salads with different kinds of lettuces as we move through the seasons. That's the great thing about what we're doing, is that we are in a seasonal place. And when it's over, it's over. And that allows us to be in the next place. And right now, we've left asparagus behind. We're in little turnips and we're grilling quail on the fire. And we're doing potato pancakes. And of course, really great desserts with strawberries.
It's strawberry season out there. I've been seeing all the photos. What are you making with those strawberries?
they've been making kind of a strawberry compote that goes on top of a panna cotta. And so they're putting it in a little glass jar and sending that out with food to go. But the most wonderful tart for me is the apricot galette that we make. And I always look forward to that at this moment in time. And it's just begun. And so we will have that probably for another month.
I'm swooning over here in Manhattan thinking of the Chez Panisse apricot galette. I love galettes. I know you do too.
Indeed.
Okay, so Alice, I was super surprised, I think it was just last week, to read that you are opening a restaurant or something restaurant-like in Los Angeles this fall. Can you tell us about this project?
First of all, this is not a Chez Panisse project in Los Angeles.
Got it.
Excuse me. This is a project that I am wanting to do at the Hammer Museum. It is a restaurant that they were looking for someone to run. And I thought, if I could find somebody who wanted to cook that I knew and somebody who could run it, I'd love to collaborate. And so I found David Tanis and Jesse McBride. And I have to say that probably my daughter moving to Los Angeles had something to do with it. But really what had most to do with it is the fact that the Hammer Museum is connected to the University of California. And I'm very engaged with the university around the ideas of regenerative food, organic regenerative food. They have a climate initiative for 2025. And I'm hoping that food can be part of that. And so the fact that this is a beautiful situation in a museum that brings together art and food, and students could be in the kitchen and could be coming and gathering at the restaurant, is irresistible to me. And that is why I am enthusiastic about it, I have to say. It is why I would support any project that really carried the values of regenerative agriculture, of beauty, of community, of diversity, of local. It just fits. And there are so many friends in Los Angeles who have worked at Chez and want to help us. It feels like, again, the extended family of Chez Panisse in a way, but it's way more than that. It's about really finding a way to communicate these values globally. And the University of California has the potential of doing that.
Well, lucky Los Angeles. I mean, you have resisted opening another location for so long. I mean, your life has been Chez Panisse and Edible Schoolyard. So why have you resisted all these years and now's the time?
I have had, needless to say, my hands full. But here we are at 50 years of Chez Panisse and 25 years of the Edible Schoolyard project. Both have extraordinary people to move them forward. And I want to be involved in any project. And I mean, whether it's slow food in Italy, whether it's the Refettorio of Massimo Battura in San Francisco, whether it is a school in the Bronx or a university that wants to hold these values, wants to go forth and teach the next generation, I am there. I will be present. And that's not like I'm opening a place myself. It's being a supporter in all ways I can to express these values as I did in my manifesto.
I was just going to say that's a great segue, because all those values you talk about, you have put into a brand new book, and it's called We Are What We Eat, A Slow Food Manifesto. Tell us about this beautiful book.
Yeah. I wanted to understand myself, how we happen to lose our human values in this last 60 years. And I've always thought about that Briat Savarin philosophical sentence that says, the destiny of nations depends on how they nourish themselves. And how have we been nourishing ourselves? We have been eating fast food, and when we're eating that food, we're eating the values that go along with the food. So we've been digesting the ideas of fast, cheap, and easy. We believe that we should be able to get anything we want 24/7. We believe that everything should be uniform. We believe that it's okay to eat in our cars. We believe that food should be cheap. That it should be cheap when it's always been, precious. We believe that it's okay to waste. There's always more where that came from. And that cooking is drudgery. That farming is drudgery. And that diversity is not desirable. That we want the same thing we've always had over and over again. And I do believe this is what has taken us down the wrong path. We've destroyed our environment, our health, and we're endangering really the future for our children. So I'm just saying that we need to understand slow food values and treasure. I mean, they've always guided my life, always, since I went to France the first time and experienced the beauty of a culture.
Now, Alice, the people who know and love you agree with you and have tried to live these values alongside you. Who did you write this book for?
I guess I wrote this book for the politicians in Washington, for the Department of Education, for the people who make the decision about school lunch. How could we feed our children fast food when we could feed them slow food for the same price? And that's my next book, is how we can do that. How we can teach about cultures of the world through a school lunch education. How we could change the world if we bought food like Shay has always done, directly from the people who take care of the land and their farm workers. What could be better?
Alice, how can we help? How can our listeners help?
How can they help? They could vary. It's, let me say, there's so many ways. But I think really communicating to the powers that be, it's a very crucial time right now. People are thinking about hunger of children. and health of children during the pandemic. But we don't just want food, fast food for our kids. We want real food. We want to support those people. And to make that definition of school lunch clear, that we want to support local economies. We don't want to buy food from around the world that's second rate and not organically grown. We don't want that food. And we can grow the food in this country. And eating seasonally is something that needs to be championed, because it really is something that makes you really connected to nature always. And in order to make the right decisions about our future, we have to fall in love with nature. We have to treasure. And seasonality is a way to really engage, to absolutely to ask where everything comes from and to eat locally. And people can have greenhouses. They can store food for the winter. There are nuts and berries and squashes and spices and all the new grains that have been discovered in the last 5 or 10 years. It's amazing.
Alice, you have planted so many seeds over the years, and I've seen so many of the green shoots and plants that have resulted from your work. Do you feel hopeful?
I've never lost my hope from the free speech movement in Berkeley in the 60s. And I knew that if we all got together, we could change the world. We feel like we really helped with civil rights. We felt like we stopped the war in Vietnam. And I felt the power of that. And I've never, ever lost my hope. And I feel that right now. And so many people have awakened during the pandemic and seen the failure of the industrial food system and seen all the hungry children and the broken school system as well. Why can't we be outside educating our children? Why can't we take them down to the beach? And this is where my hope is in public education, our last truly democratic institution. Every child goes to school, or should, as Gloria Steinem said. So I count on that we can really volunteer, that we can be engaged, because the decisions that are made right now are going to be so, so important.
Well, Alice, we are totally behind you, and you have been such an inspiration to me personally, and I know to everyone in the Bomb Squad. So I can't thank you enough for everything you've done and for putting all this into this book. I mean, everyone really should pick up a copy of We Are What We Eat. I think you will all feel very inspired by Alice's words, and it gives us a sort of path forward. Thank you again, Alice, for that and for everything you've done.
It is my pleasure.
Thank you so much to Alice for joining us. Now, let's check in with Fanny Singer, who joins us from Los Angeles. Fanny Singer, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you so much for having me, Carrie. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It is so nice to see you. It's been a while. The last I saw you and your mom, it was April of last year, and you two, I think, had just kind of become roommates.
God, I mean, that feels like yesterday, and it also feels like a million years ago. It's a very strange, it's been a strange year time-wise, but yeah, I had just moved from San Francisco into my childhood home with my mom in Berkeley, and that coincided, yeah, with the launch of my book, Always Home. So I was always home with my mom from April, well, actually really from like the end of March. So it was, I was there with her in Berkeley for 10 months.
Your book is in my bookshelf, of course. And every time I see the title, I am just struck by how prescient that title was.
Honestly, even still. And right. just no one could have foreseen how, like, the longevity and relevance that it would have, because we are still, I mean, even just now, much of the world is still in a form of quarantine. So it was a weird sort of bit of propheticism on my part. I wish it had been.
I think it says a lot about a book and a title also, that it can evolve with the times, because when you titled the book Always Home, it didn't mean what it means today. What did you mean when you gave it that title originally?
The title was meant to reflect this idea that you could feel yourself to be at home anywhere, depending on how you kind of organized different aspects of your life, and that you could recall a feeling of coziness and homeliness and things that we associate with our childhood homes often, or being with our family virtually anywhere, if you just kind of oriented yourself with a few, in my mind, kind of tricks or recipes. Tricks in the sense of, like, my mom's classic burning of rosemary to make any room smell beautiful, or just arranging some foraged flowers or any little thing like that. So it was really meant to convey this idea of, like, by making simple recipes, by gathering friends, by surrounding yourself with beauty, that you could feel a sense of real groundedness. And of course, it came to mean, here's a recipe book to use while you're trapped at home, suddenly having to cook. And, like, how do you feel comfortable? Like, how do you eat good food? How do you sort of take care of your family in times of duress? So it kind of did take on a new mean in the course of that year. But
the book is such a delightful read, and it's funnier than I expected it to be. I remember reading it last year, and, you know, people will have heard your mom before this interview, and your mom can be serious sometimes, very serious. So I just love that there was so much humor in the book. But also, you're young to have written the memoir. Why did you decide it was time to do that book?
You know, I mean, I had been asked to write, like, early on when I was 18, publishers got in touch with me to write a book. And there was so much interest there, and there always has been, and there perennially will be interest in my mom. And so, and for good reason, I think, you know, she's doing really important, compelling work. But there was always an appetite, I think, to kind of understand or see the narrative from the other side, or, you know, what does Fanny, Alice Waters' daughter, eat? I basically moved away from California and from the United States entirely to get out a little bit from under that, what was at times kind of oppressive scrutiny. And I lived in England for 11 years. I was doing a PhD in art history over there, and then I stayed. And, you know, people knew who my mom was, but only, you know, not in that way where it felt like that was the sort of epithet, you know, Alice Waters, comma, daughter, or Alice Waters's daughter, comma, Fanny Singer, you know, and that was how I was always seen. And that was an important chapter in my life, to really create something that felt kind of autonomous. Of course, the book is about, in a way, realizing that I was never far from home, you know, spiritually, and that, however, getting to do that work meant coming back to California with a different sort of feeling and footing. And it suddenly felt like kind of a nice time to reassess that relationship. And I wasn't living at home then, you know, I moved to San Francisco, but I was back, you know, with my family. And I'd started writing when I was still in England, but I was sort of anticipating the return to California. And I wanted to write the book when our relationship was still very much in the present tense, you know, because it isn't just a memoir. It is a story of a mother-daughter relationship. And I liked the idea of not sort of treating it as something that I was looking back at totally retroactively, but something that we were still working out and living through. And also, I mean, sort of selfishly asking Brigitte Lacombe to make photographs meant memorializing our relationship in that present moment when both of us still, you know, had a quality of relationship that felt more like it did when I was young than how it might in another 10 or 15 years, you know? And so it was almost like taking a snapshot in the kind of that like middle moment of both of our arcs, you know, as mother and daughter.
Those Brigitte photos are so beautiful. Do you feel the need, or are folks asking for a new final chapter?
There's definitely been some chatter and people are like, come on, give us the dirt, you know? And I was like, because this is not an expository book or one where I'm trying to reveal any sort of, you know, dirty truths.
Like I said, the book is delightful and funny. You will find yourself laughing out loud sometimes.
In a way, like, you know, because I'm also an art critic and I write about art routinely, and I and culture, do culture writing as well. And my tone is quite serious generally. And I think it was really nice and for me to actually explore the reality of my sense of humor and just sort of, and because this is how this is the lens through which I have lived this life with my mom, you know. And my mom, I think many people sort of perceive her as so like doctrinaire and very kind and lovely, but also like possibly humorless. But the reality is she loves to crack up too. And so like, you know, these, for her to read these stories and these accounts through that, you know, through that lens of humor was, I think, really a pleasure for her.
So tell us, how was it being Alice Waters' roommate for all those months?
God, it was so, I mean, it was an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing to be an adult and move back in with your parent if you love that parent, I think. You know, I mean, plenty of people have strained relationships with their parents. And, you know, I have the aforementioned difficulty of navigating her celebrity, but I don't have a difficult time with her on a, you know, personal or emotional level. And we just really love being together. And so, it was really wonderful. I mean, it was crazy at the beginning because we were doing, you know, I mean, not just dozens of virtual events. She was supposed to be on book tour at a few different locations with me for Always Home. And I was supposed to be in, you know, three different countries for the book tour. And suddenly everything was virtual. And then even other, you know, things were booked that could never have been physical events because suddenly there was that perceived opportunity. So we were just like in a constant state of like frenetic activity. So the first few months just almost evaporated, but it was strange. It was the first time I was really home since I was 18, you know, for any prolonged period of time.
Fanny, one of the things I want to talk to you about is, and this is one of the things I've always admired about you, is the creative life that you've led. And creativity seems to be this thread that has run through your life of everything you do. And even when I was thinking back, you know, I've seen all those adorable photos of you at Halloween and your homemade Halloween costumes. Was the idea of a creative life something that was nurtured in you, or is it something that just happened organically?
Well, I think kind of a little bit of both. I think I probably had an innate sort of, in a way, aptitude for art. I mean, I started making, you know, art just compulsively when I was a kid. And then I went on to study art and art history. So at college, and I think I thought I was going to, you know, be an art major and maybe be an artist. And then it was in the process of doing that, that I was like, I don't know if I have like the skill or actually like the discipline with this one thing. And now that I know so many artists through the work that I do, you know, I really respect that sort of singular drive to make and create that, that I'm never sure I had just in that vein. You know, there was always a number of things that I was interested in doing. But I, you know, I come from a family of artists. You know, my father is a painter and he also is a winemaker, but he, you know, makes incredible paintings, was painting when I was a little kid and had, you know, done a BFA at SFAI in San Francisco and had a studio in our backyard. So I was always out there, you know, sort of tootling around with him while he was painting, and he would take me to museums. And so he really nurtured a more traditional engagement with art and with, you know, institutional art. So going to museums, seeing shows that mattered to him, which is why I have a Saul LeWitt tattoo. It's like fully my dad's influence.
I missed that. Where is the tattoo and what is it of?
That is right here.
I didn't know that. Beautiful.
I got, he does not approve of tattoos, so it was not exactly, didn't exactly feel honored by that choice. But you know, my engagement with like with that world does very much come from my father's nurturing. But my mom is an artist too. You know, I mean, she, everything she, you know, touches, I mean, she's always kind of rearranging and making things like look a certain way or adhere to a certain color palette. And I talk about that a lot in my book because there is a sort of almost like fascistic, like, you know, program around aesthetics. And I grew up in a house where everything was always very beautiful and there was really zero tolerance for things that were, you know, unattractive or utilitarian. We had no plastic in the, anywhere in the house. Very little, even like stainless steel or metal. It was like warmer hues of copper and wood. And the reality that those tools that we have eschewed, because there's something more convenient or we can plug an implement into the wall and whiz something faster. It's like, it's not that they're better, you know, it's like you can actually luxuriate in the time that it takes to make something more slowly with something that's more beautiful in a way that might actually be more gratifying. And I think that's my mom's, you know, overwhelming message is, and especially in this new book too, is that slowness is actually a value and that in doing something more slowly, you engage with the beauty of the process, whether that's the smell of the spices that you can really, you know, really smell and absorb if you're pounding something versus like putting it in a closed blender and whizzing it. So that did govern the sort of aesthetic program of the house. And I do think that really rubbed off on me. I mean, I do have some modern conveniences in my kitchen, but I the two influences of my parents were sort of dovetailed, I think, in the way that I wanted to then approach my career. So, I mean, I ran a design brand called Permanent Collection, which is very much about a pretty strict kind of pared down, like minimalist, but beautiful aesthetic around kitchen and homeware, predominantly with some jewelry and garments and things. And that's a project that I started with a design historian, also from California, named Mariah Nielsen. And then I also write. I write about art and then do these occasional curatorial projects, actually, like the Absolute Project,
which we're going to talk about right now. When I heard about the Absolute Art Project that you were doing, I just thought, oh, this is so perfect. It just combines so many things that I know Fanny loves and just does so beautifully. So two questions. Tell us what absolute art is, because I know when people hear the name absolute, they mostly associate that with vodka. I know for me, I did. And then tell us about the project, because it just launched.
Yes. So Absolute Art is an organization that is within the umbrella of the vodka brand, but it is a sort of semi, I guess, autonomous, limited edition print platform. So it's kind of an online gallery where you can buy excessively priced limited edition prints by artists. And they started this, I think, really because they had cultivated so many strong artist relationships back in the 70s and 80s. And
right. Some people might remember the amazing ad campaigns.
I mean, incredible. They were all designed by artists. Mm-hmm. And you had Warhol, you had, I mean, these really big names like and Louise Bourgeois, they were associated with the brand really early on. And which is interesting to me because I think like, you know, that, I mean, obviously I had Absolute Art ads plastered all around my room.
We all did.
There was always a sort of, you know, resonance with the design aesthetic and just actual innovation.
I think I read they collaborated with more than 500 artists on those campaigns
over the
years, which is incredible. Yeah.
So this is obviously, these are not Absolute bottle prints. What they do now is they work with artists to make unique to the limited edition artwork. And then that gets printed in usually pretty small runs, like 25, 50, I think, prints per run. And they're signed prints and there you can buy them through their platform. And so when Absolute reached out to me, I had been sort of aware of what they were doing because actually Brigitte has a relationship with them and makes works and prints for them, really beautiful photographic works. And their proposal was to come up with a collection for the kitchen. And I was like, well, I really understand why you thought of me. Like, I can't think of like someone more engaged with, you know, the art world and the kitchen and like cooking and the culinary world than me. So I was like, that's maybe like the most appropriate sort of like Venn diagram overlapping situation that I've ever come across. Cause most of what I do feels sort of that there is some genetic continuity between it, but I often feel like I'm wearing different hats, you know, like I'm the art critic over here. Like now I'm like on Instagram writing a recipe for followers, you know, there is a diversity of things that I do. And this kind of really melded them. So anyways, this project is works that I I mean, what I really thought about actually in asking artists, I wanted artists who I thought might make work that would reflect how people cook. So Jeremy Deller is a conceptual artist, and his print just says Marmite on toast. You know, it's like many of his works, which are just text-based. And that's how he cooks. I mean, it's just this kind of, well, that's kind of the extent of what he engages with in the kitchen. But, you know, it's like, it's more concept than it is execution. And Heather Chantos did two beautiful prints. She's an abstract painter based in Bordeaux. And she has a huge, beautiful garden. And she used to work for years at Gourmet and then at World of Interiors. And she has this incredible depth of experience as a cook. And, you know, she cooks, and I think in a way that's quite impulsive in the way that she, similar to how she arranges, you know, light and shapes and forms in her work. So I was interested in like, okay, you've got the abstract painters, the abstract cooks, like who never follow recipes, like the ones who are very programmatic and have everything laid out first, like their recipe, you know, so the works kind of reflect that. There's also works by Rachel Kay, who's an abstract painter in San Francisco. Peter McDonald, who is, he does these like wonderful sort of between abstraction and figurative works. He has this a very unique vernacular. And then my mom, the folks at Absolute were like, do you think your mom would want to make a print? And there had been this photograph that had actually been sort of pre-approved of hers by Brigitte for another initiative that ended up falling through that was meant to be a benefit print for restaurant workers during like in the crazy crisis. And it was wonderfully able to be used as a benefit print for the Edible Schoolyard. So, and then the last is Saul Calero, who is an artist I adore, who is a Venezuelan artist based in Berlin. And she just has an incredible social practice alongside her artwork. Her print benefits a small organization in Venezuela called Feed Venezuelan Children. So it was very cool that Absolute was game for these, to do these charity prints too, so that, you know, and they have a history of doing that with various artists. They've worked with Kehinde Wiley to do a charity print. And so there's a real mix of things, and hopefully something for everyone is the idea.
It's accessible art. You know, this company that has a long history of supporting artists, which is so important and continues to be important. And the website's great. When you go on there to look at Fanny's collection, give yourself some time because you will fall down an art rabbit hole because there's a lot of beautiful art on that website.
It's true. It's true.
All right. We're going to do a quick speed round. Okay, Fanny, coffee or tea?
Tea.
How do you take it?
I'm a Sencha drinker. So I just have like a beautiful cup of very, very green, like, you know, it's always, you have to brew green tea lukewarm. So it's always like barely hot.
I probably make mine too hot.
I think that's what really changed it for me, I have to say, actually, is I didn't love the taste of green tea. And then when you brew it, the correct temperature, you don't scald the leaves. And so it has a completely different, like super green flavor as opposed to like a little bit more of an oxidized flavor.
What did you eat for breakfast today?
I did not have anything, although I'm eyeing some banana bread that I made yesterday in a like chaotic, like post-print launch, like press breakfast. And I just... I looked through, I took, in fact, posted a video to Instagram because I looked at the kitchen afterwards and it was like a tornado had ripped through. Like whenever I bake, it's total chaos.
What is your most used kitchen implement? We know it's not a microwave or something like that.
It's really the mortar and pestle that we made for a permanent collection. I just use it twice a day. Because I eat a lot of salad and I always pestle my garlic in there to make a salad dressing. And it's a little collaboration with my mom made a little kitchen collection in collaboration with us at Permanent Collection. And this is a kind of Japanese style mortar and pestle. And it's just such a useful tool. So I do use it a lot.
Salad is a big thing in your family, isn't it?
Big thing. There's like, I buy enough lettuce for one female. Every time I go to the farmer's market, this one farm is like, are you like, do you have a family of 10? I'm like, these 15 heads of lettuce will barely get me through the week.
Crazy. That came through loud and clear in your mom's interview. What was your last pantry purchase?
I got some millet, actually, because I was interested in adding millet to the banana bread, which is a big hit.
Do you listen to music in the kitchen?
I do, but it's kind of, I live in a studio, so it's kind of all one room. But I do. And it really varies. Last night I was listening to Arthur Russell's World of Echo, which is one of my favorite records while I was cooking.
What is your kitchen footwear of choice?
To be honest, it's usually my those little, I don't know, are they plastic Birkenstocks, which I'm sure would not be pass muster. You know, those ones that are just made of the foamy material, not even the leather ones, but I wear them. It's generally my footwear. When I'm being more responsible, I wear a clog because you aren't supposed to have your toes out in a kitchen.
And I know you just moved, but what is the oldest thing in your fridge?
Oh, it's some miso that's traveled to many homes. And amazingly, it's still good. But it's some miso that a friend made. And I actually think it's lived in three or four different places. And I brought it to LA.
I love that for people who move a lot, with the vinegars you take with you, the mustards, the misos, all of that. All right, Fanny, last question. If you were stuck on a desert island with one food celebrity, can't be your mom, who would it be and why?
When I was thinking about that, I was probably Francis Smallman, so that because I just feel he'd be really good person to be on an island with, the fire cooking. I feel he probably fishes I've actually never met Francis. I just adore him from afar. I know he's dear friends with my mom's, but I think that'd be a safe bet.
You'll handle the salad. He's got the fire.
I'll take care of the salad. I'll forage the greens from the forest. Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Well, Fanny, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I love you and your mom so much. And it's just so nice to see you both. And thank you for putting these wonderful projects into the world.
Oh, thank you so much, Carrie. The admiration is mutual. It's really nice to catch up.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much to Fanny Singer for joining us. Fanny's memoir is Always Home, and you can check out her curated art collection on absoluteart.com. And thank you again to her mom, Alice Waters, for joining us as well. Alice's latest book, We Are What We Eat, A Slow Food Manifesto, is out now. Thank you to our sponsor, X-Rosé, for supporting this episode. Cheers to them. Radio Cherry Bomb is a production of Cherry Bomb Magazine. Special thanks to Cherry Bomb's Jenna Sadu and to Joseph Hazen, chief engineer of Newsstand Studios at Rockefeller Center. If you enjoyed today's show, be sure to sign up for our newsletter over at cherrybomb.com. Stay on top of all of our episodes, special events, happenings, and more. And thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.